Good morning, everyone. I will call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. A quorum is present. So members, in accordance with House Rule 10.05, Representative Quam will be participating in today's hearing remotely by phone with the speaker's approval. So I just wanted to note that. So we are in a bit of a new world with remote participation, which I think is a good thing. And I don't know Representative Quam's reason for that, but whatever it is, I do encourage folks, if you feel ill, please do that and stay home. And that would be a really good thing. So appreciate that we're able to do that with members. So with that, the first order of business is approval of the minutes of February 9th, 2023. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move approval of the minutes of February 9th, 2023.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. So is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So first bill on the agenda is House File 1159, Representative Fisher. And Representative Fisher, House File 1159, he's moving that to bring it before the committee, and the intention is for it to be laid over. Is that correct, Representative Fisher?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So Representative Fisher, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Appreciate the opportunity to present House File 1159. I'd also like to thank my co-author, Representative New Brindley, who's also co-author on the bill. 1159 is a bill that addresses the Drug Formulary Committee makeup and structure. It's to encourage public participation and ensure transparency. I know some people are probably wondering, well, what the heck is the Drug Formulary Committee? It is a committee that's responsible for managing the Minnesota Public Health Care Program's preferred drug list and evaluate whether drugs covered by public programs should be subject to prior authorization and what the authorization criteria should be. And so that's a little bit what the committee is about. What this bill does is it does some things to help increase transparency and change the structure a little bit. In terms of participation, it increases the number of physicians, make sure that we have them strategically located throughout the state of Minnesota, make sure that we've got somebody who's also through different specialties, make sure we have the different specialties, particularly the rare diseases specialty represented. Ensures the number of consumer representatives, those who are medical assistants, making sure they're part of the program, and making sure we have at least one person from the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council. Some of the things that we're also wanting to make sure is that there's a way for the people to be reappointed, making sure the committee meets at least six times a year, make sure they know they're subject to the open meeting law. And then also there's a sunset on it, and the sunset is originally for June 30th of this year. They still have a lot of work to do. So part of it is to move the sunset to June 30th of 2027. Some of the things that it's going to require to be happen is that it requires that the preferred drug list and supplemental rebate program must be publicly disclosed. Make sure that we have an archive so people can see what the archive has been for the list of the past. Making sure that when we're modifying the drug list, to make sure to consult with the appropriate advocacy groups, and the Minnesota Rare Disease Council is another important one. We also want to make sure that as we're going forward, that we're requiring disclosure of the medical and clinical analysis that goes along with the proposed changes, and make sure that when the committee has a hearing, we know at least 45 days in advance, and then at least 30 days in advance, we have an opportunity to know what are the drugs that are going to be discussed, what the meeting agenda is going to be. So I will pause there. I do have a testifier with me today.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Fisher. So Sarah Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Goodnow, and I am the Advocacy and Public Policy Manager at the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1159, which will modify the Drug Formulary Committee composition and make changes to the process of updating the preferred drug list. The Drug Formulary Committee and the preferred drug list have a significant impact on how people who use medical assistance are able to access medications in Minnesota. The Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota supports adding additional consumer representatives and providers with expertise in rare disease, disability, and pediatrics, because that diversity of thought, practice, and information will encourage the committee to look beyond the explicitly clinical data and into the lives of patients. such as a child with a rare epilepsy diagnosis whose parents need to crush her pills daily and feed them to her and her food because the preferred drug list and the prior authorization criteria wouldn't cover the liquid version for her. This is just one example. We have heard similar stories where prior authorization of a liquid version of medication is repeatedly denied for children using a feeding tube, which could lead to crushed pills clogging their G-tube. In these cases, the matter of application is not a matter of convenience, but it is a matter of life or death. This may sound dramatic, but for epilepsy and a number of other chronic conditions, a single missed dose can have significant consequences. Diverse clinical and patient experience and expertise as voting members of the Drug Formulary Committee is essential to ensuring that the best decisions are made with people who are directly impacted by those decisions. I encourage your support for House File 1159, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Nadeau.
Oh, my gosh. I get the first one. Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate it. Can you tell, on line 2.26, can you talk to me a little bit about appropriate patient advocacy groups that the commissioner may add, delete, please? Representative Fisher?
Representative Fisher.
Certainly. I'll lean on my testifier here a little bit on that. Is first of all, we want to make sure that the Rare Disease Advisory Council was incorporated in there. And there have been other groups. Sometimes they may be addressed more to a particular advocacy if you're in the epilepsy world or if you're advocating for in cancer and some of those. There's different groups that are set up as what I call advocates are set up in those spaces. So it's making sure that we don't miss them. But it could be a very long list, and we didn't want to sit here and, you know, list all of them because it feels like typically they're usually included, but sometimes some areas are missed, and that's why we had the one spelled out. And I'll refer to my testifier for anything.
Ms. Goodnow, anything to add there?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. For example, if there are going to be changes made to the anticonvulsant area of the preferred drug list, we recommend that the Drug Formulary Committee directly refer to the Epilepsy Foundation and ask what our position is, what our doctors think, what our patient experience is, in order to make sure that those changes have a patient and provider expertise, and also so they don't get missed, because fixing the problem later is not as effective as getting in front of it.
Follow-up, Representative Nadeau?
Just quickly, and thank you, Madam Chair. And you think that the language that as it's written is inclusive in that way? It talks about the commissioner may add, delete, otherwise modify the preferred drug list after consulting with those appropriate groups. He doesn't have to, he may. I'm not saying that it should be shall at all. It just seems worded interesting to me. That's it. So as long as you guys are comfortable, I think that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fisher, I've had some contact with patients and healthcare providers about certain drugs that are not included on the formulary, and I'm just wondering about what the process will be to add them and what it looks like for items that are not included that need prior authorization. What does that process look like, and what is the participation of the patients involved in this?
And Representative Fisher, and I wonder, too, if we have someone from DHS, is that what you're going to tell me?
Yes, Madam Chair. I was going to say DHS would be the best to answer that question right there.
Great. Great. Mr. Hope is coming down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Chad Hope. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS, and I oversee the pharmacy program under which the Drug Formulary Committee lives.
Did you want that repeated?
Yes, please.
All right. Representative Bierman.
Thank you. So the drug list, if there are medications that are not included in the formulary, what does the process look like to get those added if it's going to be an incredibly hard thing to get them added when they're needed? And then also, what is the process for that determination? What role or what participation level might patients or their caregivers, not their caregivers, but their, you know, family members have in that process?
Mr. Hope.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, so those are actually two different things, so I'll tackle one at a time. In the Medicaid pharmacy benefit, there is not what you would call a formulary. Every single drug that the manufacturers have agreed to participate in the federal Medicaid rebate program is part of the drug benefit. It's very different from a commercial plan where they have a rigid formulary and things that are non-formulary are essentially non-accessible. In the Medicaid program, the only way a drug is not part of the benefit is if the manufacturer said, I do not want my drugs used in the Medicaid population nationally. It's a very small number of medications, and we actually have state law that prevents us from including those in the pharmacy benefit because they don't qualify for federal funding. So the formulary aspect is essentially everything is in except for a few select products where the manufacturers have opted out nationally. As far as prior authorization goes, the formulary committee is the venue through which we gather public input and clinical recommendations as to whether or not to subject drugs to prior authorization. There are public comment opportunities in advance of the committee, so we can take written comments and submit them to the members. We accept public comments at the meetings, and we also accept public comments following the meetings so that we can have follow-up comments. So there is a robust public comment opportunity. It is not limited to prescribers. It can be members, family members, advocates, interested organizations. So that exists today.
Representative
Madam Chair,
Bierman.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering about conditions where there's a patient needing care now. And so the process could take a while, it sounds like. And so I'm just wondering if there's a way, if it's a needed drug, if it's not on the formulary, but it is one that the family or the patient would want, is there a way to access that drug in this process? And one particular example would be liquid methadone for kids.
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, so liquid methadone is a covered benefit. I believe it is subject to prior authorization. However, in the Medicaid program, again, our prior authorizations are very different than commercial insurance. We have a federal requirement that we have to respond back to prior authorization requests within 24 hours, whereas in the commercial space, that requirement does not exist. So those sorts of differences are what separate a Medicaid pharmacy benefit from a commercial plan.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question for the author. What's the purpose of the sunset provision in this bill?
Oh, Representative Fisher.
It seems like a good idea to have this formulary committee. So why would you want to get rid of it?
In terms of, I will first of all say that I don't know what the history on this particular sunset was. I do know that when I've worked with other task force or committees that have been set up, it's always been a good idea to set it out for like 5 years or whatever to see how effective it is, and will they still be needing to function after that point in time. So it was something to automatically check back in. I would say that this is probably a comfort language holdover from that era.
Okay. Thank
Representative
you.
Carroll. Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay. So I have a question as well. I'm glad Mr. Hope is there. I could really direct it to him. So just to be clear, Mr. Hope, this is about the approximately 20% of medical assistance recipients who are on fee-for-service. Am I right? This does not. So if you would just explain, does this, what we're talking about here, the formulary and the formulary committee, we're not talking about those Minnesotans who are getting their MA coverage through managed care organizations. Am I right about that, or does this also cover them?
Madam Chair, so directly, this usually applies to fee-for-service. However, it does impact managed care in that we have a uniform preferred drug list across fee-for-service and the managed care organizations. And the crafting of the preferred drug list is done through the Drug Formulary Committee, through our public process. So at the point the preferred drug list places a drug as preferred or non-preferred, the managed care plans must follow that requirement as well.
Okay, good to know. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I I was thinking about what we had just talked about, and I had another question. I'm not sure. I heard you, when we talked about liquid methadone, you mentioned 24 hours. What's the time delay for other products that might be necessary or desired that are not included on the list?
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative. So the preferred drug list is a subset of the drugs that are part of the pharmacy benefit. It is not in any way inclusive of all drug classes. It's the drug classes where there's competition, where you can scale it such that you can have preferred and non-preferred and clinically interchangeable products, or at least scale them up and have a robust drug class. So some drugs that are, for instance, if a drug is only the only drug indicated to treat a rare condition, it's not going to be on the preferred drug list because it is the only product. What are you going to stage it against? There's not really that preferred, non-preferred delineation. So, for example, cholesterol medications are a good example. Everyone's familiar with the Lipitors and Crestors and Zocors. Those are the sorts of drug classes that you're thinking about when you're thinking about a preferred drug list. So the fact that a drug is not on the preferred drug list does not in any way mean that it's not covered. If a drug is not covered, that means the manufacturer has opted out of having their product in the national Medicaid program. Very unusual.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you. So very unusual. I'm not sure I'm understanding whether or not a drug would be provided if it was requested for a condition where you know, I talk to people all the time about certain drugs that they have had or that they know they work for them, and then sometimes the formularies change, and I'm just, in this instance, I'm just trying to clarify if there's a process that patients can you know, talk to their medical providers and get the drugs that they would prefer in those cases. And I know you gave 24 hours on the one product. I'm just trying to understand if there's a process for this and what the timeline might be.
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, if a drug is subject to prior authorization, which is what it sounds like you're saying, the 24-hour response time would apply. However, I cannot guarantee that preference for a product would result in approval. Some drugs have very specific indications. And it's going to depend. So I can't make a blanket statement to say preference.
Madam Chair, thank you.
All right.
Mr. Hope.
All right, thank you. Okay, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing that line of inquiry, I'm interested in how a drug would become part of the preferred list versus the non-preferred list. And I understand that it's only when there are multiple, and you may have said this and I just might not have sorted in my head, but to me there's a whole area where if managed care can have access to the preferred list but not necessarily the non-preferred list, what is the process for a patient, and what is the process for challenging whether something is on the preferred or non-preferred? How is that established? Thank you.
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, and at any point, please cut me off if I'm taking your answers.
No, go ahead.
So
that's way out of my league.
The preferred and non-preferred status for the drugs are what the Drug Formulary Committee is discussing and debating at the meeting. So we take the public comments. We'll have individual requests from manufacturers, advocacy organizations, members of the community, you name it, that would lobby for one drug to be either preferred or non-preferred. And the committee will weigh that relative to the clinical discussion that's occurring. Once a drug is placed in a preferred or non-preferred status, the managed care plans have to follow that preferred and non-preferred status, same as fee-for-service does. A member would also have to seek a prior authorization for a non-preferred drug through the managed care plans if they wanted to access that. And the managed care plans are also subject to the 24-hour response time.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my last follow-up is, what is the recourse for a patient if their request for prior authorization is denied? Thank you.
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, so if a prior authorization is denied, the member can request a fair hearing.
Okay, thank you. Representative Elkins?
Yeah, real quick, Madam Chair. I feel like I ought to know the answer to this, but does it,
And if you could just talk in the mic a little more.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the mic's in here and not the best.
Lousy, yes, this room is lousy mics. An MCO uses your formulary, not their own, right? For Medicare Advantage, or not for medical assistance.
Yeah. So, Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, so yes, the managed care plans use our preferred drug list.
Yeah.
The entire formulary is also inclusive for the MCOs.
Yeah.
However, it's a little confusing that the MCOs will use the term formulary and non-formulary in what we call our list of covered drugs. Mm-hmm. But just to be clear, they are subject to the same requirement that fee-for-service is. Any drug that's part of the rebate program is part of their benefit as well.
So they're, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, so they're not going through their own PBM. They're going through you for drugs.
Oh, Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, no. The managed care plans all have contracted PBMs that are processing their claims for them.
Yes, and so, members, we are, I know, this is obviously of deep interest,
yes.
And it's really good. We appreciate you being here, Mr. Hope, but we appreciate the bill so that we can get a little bit of education about all of this. I just want to put a pause for a second and just ask Mr. Harney about the fiscal note.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, a fiscal note has been requested. It's not done yet. I will note for the committee that the governor's bill for this committee has an initiative that repeals the same sunset that Representative Fisher outlines in his bill. Since the preferred drug list is the main work of the responsibility, rather, of the Drug Formulary Committee, the sunset removes the advantageous supplemental rebates it receives, meaning that under current law, its expiration goes with the supplemental rebates. So this bill would have, if you adopt similar language from the governor's budget proposal, approximately $45 million in the upcoming biennium.
It would. Is that a cost?
It's a savings.
It's a savings.
Excuse me.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
that's important.
So let me put a fine point on that. This bill saves a lot of money,
yes.
Probably. But we don't have the fiscal note yet, but we are laying the bill over. So just to note for members. And okay, so I think with that, I do have another question as well. And maybe, I don't know if this would be for Mr. Hope or maybe for Chair Fisher, but so going back to that language that Representative Nadeau flagged for us, appropriate patient advocacy groups, my question's a little more broad than that. To what degree is the drug industry either involved or not involved in making these decisions? So when I see appropriate patient advocacy groups, you know, many of those groups are, they're patient advocacy groups, and but sometimes the industry also kind of gets behind patient advocacy too. So I just kind of wonder, as a general question, maybe this really is for Mr. Hope, like to what degree are there safeguards against sort of marketing in this space, and you know what goes on the preferred list, and is that kind of the whole point here of having the advisory committee to make sure these are clinical decisions and decisions focused on patients and not decisions that are in any way driven by the need to sell certain drugs or, you know, the stuff that we always worry about here, that excessive profits are going into pockets and things like that. So, Mr. Hope, I hope you can get to that one.
Madam Chair, I will say that the department met with some of the advocates last week, and we are offering technical assistance. I don't believe that has been delivered yet, so some of the language, such as what was flagged earlier, we have provided some TA or are in the process of doing that. As far as whether manufacturers are involved with the preferred drug list, I would say yes, the manufacturers are heavily present at the DFC meetings. For better or worse, they get an opportunity to provide public comment, We certainly want to consider relevant clinical factors because, yes, that is the point of the Drug Formulary Committee. We do not simply want to just prefer all the lowest cost drugs. We want to prefer the lowest cost drugs when they're clinically appropriate or when it's providing clinical choice for the providers and members. So we do allow for the manufacturers to participate in that public comment process. However, we have to be very conscious of the fact that there may be ulterior motives behind some of the comments, that some of those were flagged in the Grassley report at the federal level. I believe it was in the mid-2010s, and there was actually a bill in 2019 at the federal level regarding pharmacy and therapeutic committees. It did not pass, but it references some of the issues that you're flagging now about conflicts of interest relative to the Drug Formulary Committee.
Okay, thank you. Okay, not seeing any other member questions, but really appreciate this bill. And of course, in laying over a bill, it gives us also the opportunity to continue to get the technical assistance and take input from members as well. So thank you very much, Ms. Goodnow and Representative Fisher. And with that, House File 1159 is laid over for possible inclusion. So next bill on the agenda is House File 1032, Representative Bierman. And so Representative Bierman is going to move that House File 1032 be laid over for possible inclusion. Is that your motion, Representative Bierman? All right, so the bill is before the committee, and go ahead and present your bill, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I am very pleased to provide House File 1032. When I first heard this bill for the creation of a medication repository in Minnesota in 2019, I was all in. I had just been on a tour of a retirement community, and I had visited with the pharmacy team and witnessed the destruction of unused medications. I was struck by such waste of so many prescription drugs. In 2019, the bill passed in bipartisan fashion, and the repository was up and running under the Board of Pharmacy by the end of 2020. Presently, now today, the repository has 20 clinic and pharmacy partners in 11 unique counties. However, these partners have served patients residing in 15 counties. Now, we need to help expand this program across the entire state. This will require some funding to hire more than the one current staff member. Members, this bill is about medication access. It is about addressing the high cost of medication, and it is about addressing medication waste. The Minnesota Medication Repository Program is called Roundtable RX, and we are among 12 states in the country with such a program. Medications are donated to the repository primarily from a few nursing homes. They are inspected by a pharmacist. The pharmacists confirm that the drugs are unopened and not adulterated or misbranded, unexpired, and not a controlled substance. Then they enter them into inventory. Partner clinics and pharmacies, known as local repositories, can access the inventory, order medication, and dispense them at little to no cost for qualified patients. Medications are available to uninsured and underinsured Minnesota residents. Roundtable RX is a safety net program delivering needed medications to Minnesotans for improved health and reducing pharmaceutical waste. A 2015 EPA study estimated that 740 tons of drugs are wasted annually in long-term care facilities. Thus far in Minnesota, we have redirected usable pharmaceuticals valued at nearly $1 million, but we have hardly scratched the surface of what is possible. With over 350 long-term care facilities in the state, the potential to redirect the waste stream of pharmaceuticals back into healthcare utilization is extraordinary. Iowa has redirected over $85 million worth of unused pharmaceuticals. To help us understand more about the potential of this program and how it operates, we are privileged to have Dr. Rachel Rockwell present, and I would appreciate the committee hearing from her, please. Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. My name is Rachel Rockwell. I am the Executive Director and Pharmacist in Charge for the Minnesota Medication Repository Program. I am also the sole employee for the program. We are here today to discuss legislation amendment to 151.555, which would add funding to the program. Patients often skip doses or go without medicine when cost is a barrier. A Kaiser Family Foundation 2022 report found that 3 in 10 adults reported cost as the primary reason for not taking their medications as prescribed in the past year. Discount coupons, manufacturer assistance programs, and charitable pharmacies can ease the financial burden, but these programs carry restrictions that exclude certain groups, require lengthy applications, delaying access, or remain unaffordable despite their discount. Furthermore, the U.S. long-term care industry discards billions of dollars worth of unexpired quality access medication annually. The Minnesota Medication Repository Program addresses these issues simultaneously by providing long-term care entities a place to donate unused quality safe medications for redistribution to under-resourced Minnesotans who would otherwise go without. All uninsured and nearly all underinsured Minnesota residents qualify, making the Minnesota Medication Repository Program especially valuable for seniors on Medicare and persons with high deductibles. The program is pharmacist-run and licensed by the Board of Pharmacy. Pharmacists inspect, as mentioned, inspect all products for quality and safety before accepting and redistributing them to Minnesotans in need. Between 2021 and 2022, a 2,000% increase in medication redistribution was experienced by the Minnesota Medication Repository Program. To date, the program has distributed nearly 25,000 days worth of medication to under-resourced Minnesotans statewide. The Minnesota Medication Repository Program seeks state funding to ensure program sustainability and support this exponential growth. The impact provided by the program is best illustrated through testimonials from our recipients. Earlier this year, a senior citizen in rural Minnesota faced challenges obtaining their expensive cancer medication. They reported to us, I quote, "The foundation I was with ran out of funds," end quote. Thankfully, the patient secured this $16,000 medication from the Minnesota Medication Repository Program at little to no cost to them and was able to continue their treatment. I quote from the patient, "This was a godsend," they exclaimed. Help the Minnesota Medication Repository Program continue our mission-driven work of rerouting quality medications out of the waste stream and into the hands of Minnesotans in need by supporting this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to testify today.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rockwell, for being here today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So questions, starting with Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I appreciate you being here and the work you're doing, Representative Bierman. This is something that came across my desk a long time ago. And I think it's showing what it can do to save for people. But let's talk about what the costs are to get this program going and what would be needed. It hasn't up until now needed much for funding. So what would be our expectation of costs that would expand this over the state?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the ask in the bill is $450,000. That is mostly for staffing. They also would need a larger space. I think the space they're working in now is about 400 square feet is all. Mm-hmm. And so for what they're doing and accomplishing with that, it's great. But in order to ramp it up, you do need more staffing that would actually be paid help, more pharmacists who would have more time to put into it and work on getting connections with more and more long-term care centers. and getting that inflow up to a level that they can then turn around and send it out.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, that makes sense. My concern is, and they were wonderful in showing me by video the storage area that they have and Rebecca's fine offices with lots of shelves. Nothing decorative except for drugs. Anyway, but I would want to know, how would we go about doing this? We certainly aren't going to do this for every nursing home. Can you kind of explain how you're collecting them now and how, when it expands to the state area, would that be? Is there going to be some transportation costs, or how would we get the drugs in the different areas?
Was that for Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair, I will let Dr. Rockwell take over on the exact intricacies of their operation.
Okay, Dr. Rockwell. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So our medications we do receive from long-term care facilities, whether they're pharmacies or facilities themselves. However, we do partner with another nonprofit organization. So one of our values is to be resourceful. So we are being resourceful in that we partner with a nonprofit organization that actually covers the cost of shipping the medications to us, helps us with the logistics of creating and establishing these partnerships with long-term care facilities. The issue right now, though, is we could receive as many donations as we can. However, I'm still only one person, and so we just can't physically get through the inventory and then get it out the door as just a single individual. Does that answer the question? Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Keel.
I'll just do one more here. My concern is some of the drugs you handle have certainly got requirements for temperature and safety in that realm. So when I'm thinking about Minnesota as such a large state, I can understand why you need more help with getting this out and helping everyone that needs drugs that are pretty expensive. Or those daily drugs, too, that just have to happen, especially when you get a little bit older. My list is getting way too long for myself. So anyway, but how would that be handled by mail? Just, I know I'm asking detail that we probably don't need to know, but I'm curious as to how that would go. So,
Dr. Rockwell.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. That is a great question. So we are, as pharmacists and as a healthcare entity, we are committed to quality and safety. So we actually do not accept or redistribute any medications that require storage or temperature requirements outside of room temperature, because we cannot guarantee the quality and safety, especially for things like insulin or anything that's refrigerated. We can't guarantee that cold chain of storage when we receive it, and we're not going to explore that at this time for redistribution either.
Thank you. All right. Good to know that. Okay. Representative, so I've got Representative New Brindley, then Carol, then Bonner. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering, Representative Bierman, I'm looking through the contract requirements, and I think it looks great. My question says that it requires the board to annually audit the expenditure by the repository, any money appropriated by the legislature and transferred to the board, to ensure that money is used for purposes specified in the contract. I'm wondering if we could also just consider a report to the legislature on that, so that we can see it's being done. And so maybe if that were just submitted to the legislature, that would be helpful. And then, sorry, I'm scrolling to the last page here. I appreciate the clarification that, and just to make sure I heard correctly, you'll be asking for $450,000 this year. The docs will be filled in with $450,000. Is that the idea?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, yes, that would be $450,000.
And Representative Bierman, is that per year or per biennium?
I think that would be for this biennium, and then we're going to have to reevaluate in 2 years and see where we are at.
Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We probably will need some clarification on that. It does include base funding, that doesn't have an amount filled in, but I think that that would be wise to do that for the 2 years and reevaluate. I mean, it seems like this has been a really good, successful program that we would want to consider, but it probably makes sense to reevaluate once we put more funding into it. And so then my last question would just be, and maybe just a little bit more specific than where Representative Keel was going with this, I'm wondering, what is the expected growth that you anticipate in the program, and what are you expecting to do specifically with the $450,000? Is that two FTEs? Is it two pharmacists? Is it a pharmacist and assistants? What are we thinking? How are those funds going to be used?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an answer, but I think with Dr. Rockwell here, we should get her answer.
Okay, Dr. Rockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So the money would be used to hire one additional full-time pharmacist as well as an additional full-time technician. And then, I'm sorry, could you repeat the second part of the question?
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just be curious to know what growth you would expect to see in the program. And I guess another way to say that is, how do you feel like the program has maybe been constricted so far? What do you anticipate can happen?
Dr. Rockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, so between 2021 and 2022, we experienced a 2,000% increase in simply the number or the volume of medications that we distributed. We anticipate that increase to continue exponentially. Of course, we are restricted to, our growth rate is restricted by the number of people that can work for us, and then also, with that being said, the number of people that work there, the amount of medication that we can accept and then redistribute. So that is the limiting factor. That and also cultivating relationships and partnerships with clinics and pharmacies. Now that some very important clinics and pharmacies have become partners with us, it's becoming more of a desire to pursue that partnership. So yes, I do anticipate that exponential growth to continue. And then in terms of partnership, our partnerships nearly tripled between 2021 and 2022. So we went from 5 partnerships in 2021 to a total of 18 partnerships at the end of 2022. And already this year, in just less than two short months, we've already added 2 new additional partnerships with many in the pipeline. Thank you.
Representative New Brindley, final question.
Final question. Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing I would ask about is under subdivision 15, seeking grants and other funds. And I'm wondering if you have something in mind there. Is there other funding that you believe is available to help? And what would be the intention with that funding as well?
So,
Madam Chair, we'll keep Dr. Rockwell in the hot seat on this one.
Okay. Dr. Rockwell.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. So the we do want to seek state funding, obviously, because we can't grow without it, but we don't want to be fully dependent on state funding. We do anticipate seeking out grant funding to help with other smaller projects, but a majority of our funding we do seek from the state. This would be a similar structure to what other state repository programs work underneath in terms of funding. Thank you.
Okay. And before I go to the next member, Dr. Rockwell, also, you haven't really mentioned all of the volunteers that work mm-hmm. with you. And could you just say a word about that? Because I know you have quite a few people. You haven't done this single-handedly, although I'm sure you're very capable. But
yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. So, again, one of our values is to be resourceful. And thankfully, there are a lot of great pharmacists in our community that do volunteer a few hours here and there just to help us verify all the medications that we receive as donations, check them for safety before we add them into inventory. So we do have pharmacists that help us do that. As volunteers, granted, volunteers are volunteers in their nature, so can be a little bit inconsistent. We also have a lot of interns, pharmacy students that are pharmacy interns that volunteer with us and help us with those projects, as well as other folks that are not in the pharmacy world that help us with things like social media and just other projects. So we do welcome, and we do have a lot of volunteers that that we're glad to have.
Thank you. So I'm going to go to Representative Carroll, then I've got Bonner, Nadeau, and then Keel. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. So why don't you just stay in that hot seat? You look cool and collected. Looks like we could handle it. First, let me just say, Chair, to Representative Bierman, I want to thank him for his leadership in this area. It's one I've thought about for some time, having visited my parents and others in the hospital long-term care setting and seeing the amount of apparently necessary waste of pharmaceuticals and thinking, can't something be done? And so I really appreciate your efforts on this. Now, getting to Dr. Rockwell, one of my main concerns, and I think when we visited in my office, you answered them, but I want you to discuss them. I was worried about safeguards for the medication and what provisions there would be to safeguard the integrity of the medicines and adulteration and all that sort of thing. I'm satisfied with them, although I do have one question. So some of your safeguards rely upon visual inspection of the medicine. And as a trained pharmacist, licensed pharmacist, you feel comfortable in being able to look at a medication and deem it unadulterated and safe.
Dr. Rockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Great question. So, yes, we do, in to some extent, rely on visual inspection of the medication to ensure their quality and safe. With that, as a pharmacist, we do have a substantial amount of training and knowledge in knowing which medications can be trusted, I guess, for a visual inspection and which ones are a little bit more subject to quality and safety concerns that we wouldn't be able to pick up with a visual inspection. So, for example, those would be refrigerated products. So we do use our clinical judgment to determine what classes or what types of medications we should not accept and should not redistribute for safety and quality reasons, simply because the pharmacokinetics or the essence of that medication, we can't. I guess we can't guarantee it. It's a little bit more of a narrow safety and quality requirement. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Great. Representative Carroll.
One more question. So I get it with regard to medication that must be refrigerated. What about that doesn't need to be refrigerated and the application of heat in terms of its integrity? Does excessive heat degrade it, or is that not an effect?
Dr. Rockwell.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, so medications are subject to quality and degradation in quality and safety and efficacy if they're exposed to excessive heat, cold, or excessive humidity. With that being known, we are very stringent on what we will and will not accept as a donation of medication. So like you know, most of the medications we receive come from long-term care facilities where they are a healthcare entity that is proper. We know they've properly stored the medication. They have to per requirements. So we generally accept all of those medications. We do on a much smaller scale accept medications from individuals. However, they do have to go through a fairly rigorous interview process to make sure that they stored it properly because, you know, if they're storing it in a kitchen, bathroom, anything like that, and it's subject to fluctuations in temperature and humidity, we won't accept it, period, because we can't guarantee its integrity. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Bonner, Nadeau, and Keel. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Bierman and to Dr. Rockwell for being here. I am a super fan of this simply because daughter of a nurse, 43 years, and grew up next door to a pharmacist. And I can tell you one of the conversations we frequently heard from the nurses and the pharmacists was, if only there were a way to have a way to redistribute these medications in a way that was safe and effective. And so thank you for that. And by the way, my niece is actually a volunteer for your program, so appreciate that. But I do actually have a question, actually two, and I hope they're easy ones. The first is, in the sections on the reporting, so from lines, I think it's 3.6 down to 3.20. You talk about the report, and then it adds on 3.18 the idea of an audit. And I just want to clarify, we are talking about two separate things. We're talking about a report and an audit. That section is not referring to simply the report.
Representative Bierman?
They are two separate things, Madam Chair. Yes. Thank you, Representative Bonner.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. That helps. So then my question then is, and a little bit, it kind of leads into a little bit of the point that Lead New Brindley made, which I appreciate the report, and I also appreciate the idea of having a report back to the legislature, and I know with the two-year time limit, there is likely to be some of that, but I'm just curious on the report itself. There is nothing in this language that indicates the frequency of said report. And I'm curious what that would look like. Is it a monthly report? Is it, and how, and kind of just a clarification on how we might actually be able to see the results of that, particularly for the legislature to kind of evaluate and see how things are going. Maybe it's month to month, maybe whatever it is, but just curious. I realize we don't want to be too prescriptive in the language, but it would be nice to know if we have a sense of that.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Bonner, I think you're right. The legislature does not need that many reports. I think once every 2 years to take a look at this would be fine. The reporting back to the pharmacy board, I would presume that is a monthly number, but Dr. Rockwell perhaps can inform me better.
Dr. Rockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. We don't have a number for frequency to report out. I would be glad to explore that and return back to you with an answer, whether it's monthly or annually.
Yeah, and I don't know if the Board of Pharmacy, someone may be here from the board, but it probably will have to do with how the board wants to handle it as well, right? Because, I mean, we do know that as legislators, we get lots and lots and lots of reports, and if I was to give you all a quiz on who reads them all or something, we probably, not many of us would pass because we get a lot of reporting. And so we want to make sure the reports we get are meaningful and not so frequent we can't read them. And the same is probably true of the board. So, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bierman. So I can't, I understand that this is a repository redistribution bill, but I can't get out of my head that could it also be a disposal bill? I mean, we're dealing with an enormous amount of opioids out on the streets, and regular prescription drugs that we're spending a lot of time and energy trying to collect at the county level, everywhere. Sheriff's offices are trying to, you know, dispose of these things. I'm not trying to complicate your bill at all. I'm just wondering if you thought about the capacity for this to also collect some of those prescriptions that we know we need to get off the street, and from an environmental standpoint, from a water quality standpoint, from a public health standpoint, that we could also possibly accommodate that with a structure that seems to be under consideration in this bill.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I think you bring up a really good point that is of concern in every single community across the state where we dispose of drugs. They should not go down the drain. That we know, at least a lot of people know, some don't. So it is an issue. But I certainly don't believe that it would be a wise addition to this particular bill, because with the amount of staff and the professionalism of screening these products for reuse, I think that they need to stay focused on that mission, getting good drugs out. And we're, like I said, we have barely scratched the surface of what's possible here in the state of Minnesota. But you do bring up a very valid point that, you know, we should be thinking more about. I think in my community, you can bring medications to the police station, for instance. And then what happens to them? I haven't asked that question. I presume they're not putting them in the drain at the police station, but it is a valid point, and I think that, you know, controlling pharmaceuticals that people are not using and just leaving them in medicine cabinets is indeed a danger to folks that are looking for drugs, and we want to make them limited. But I think not in this bill. That's my comment. I can let Dr. Rockwell comment if she has a thought on this, too.
Yeah, if she wants to. You don't have to, but Dr. Rockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Representative. I would not explore it for similar reasons that Representative Bierman stated, at least not at this time, because we want to make sure to keep the repository program and any disposal programs separate. We wouldn't want those streams of medications to, you know, at all collide. If it is something that would be of interest, it's certainly something we could look into, but it has not been considered at this time.
Yeah, and I would just say that Representative Nadeau, as a first-term member, this is how good ideas get started. And I would just encourage you to explore that idea. I mean, it might be a little bit late this session to start with a new bill, but, you know, we have next year, and I think that it's, you know, as Representative Bierman said, it's an interesting idea. It's certainly a problem to be solved, and, you know, I just would encourage you, if you have interest in that, to start working on it. It would be fine. We would appreciate that. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we sit here, members, and listen to this bill, I have to say, this is a great idea. I think it's a wonderful idea. But I think the members all need to know this bill actually came from student pharmacists. Dr. Mann sits in the audience. Dr. Rockwell is here, but they were in school, and they came to my office and said, hey, we have an idea. We'd like to try this, and here we are. And it's taken a long time to bring it forward, but I think the members need to know that some of our wonderful ideas come, well, most of them do in my world, come from somebody outside of this place. That they're suggesting a situation that is visual, and they're seeing it, and the waste that was going on, and is a wonderful way to recycle, reuse drugs that are costly anyway, and to help people and both sides of that in our nursing home. So I just wanted to point that out, because as I see Dr. Mann here, and she's kind of blushing, but wave your hand so everyone knows. Yes. I'm just really impressed with these students and what they came forward with. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Killian. I can't actually see her from where I'm sitting, so I didn't actually know she was here. So thank you for that. I did sort of wonder, but no, you're right. I mean, this has been had great bipartisan support over the years, and a lot of work was done to explain the concept and get it off the ground. And so, absolutely. And so this is kind of the next big moment for this concept is to have a contract with the Board of Pharmacy to actually, you know, move it away from just all of the volunteer. And Dr. Mann herself, I understand, has been volunteering with this effort for quite a long time, and actually give them the resource to hire more staff and move to the next level. So, I mean, it is definitely a great bipartisan work and shows how much we can really accomplish. So, thank you. Any closing words, Representative Bierman?
Just a thank you for the members, for the good discussion, the good ideas, and we've taken some notes up here. I think one important point I would point out is in talking with Dr. Rockwell and Dr. Mann, the growth is really determined by, you know, how much help we can bring to bear, and they will grow as much as they are able within the constraints of that. And so this is really important that we take the next step on this bill and this with this outfit. And I will also comment that in the five retirement communities that I am closely aligned with and talk to, they would all participate in this if there was, if they could find a way to do it. And so I think, again, we've barely scratched the surface, and we need to keep going forward because, you know, ultimately this is, as you've seen, it's a great bill. It improves that access. It addresses the cost. It improves therapy adherence for many Minnesotans. Iowa's reporting a 7-to-1 return on investment, and it will help the environment. That was mentioned, too. So, members, I ask for your support.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Bierman. And with that, House File 1032 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Dr. Rockwell. Next bill is House File 1665, Representative Bierman. And this one we're going to just do an informational hearing because we kind of got the bill late, but our intention, I think, would be to include it in a larger bill anyway. So, Representative Bierman to House File 1665.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1665 comes to us today as a Board of Pharmacy request to the legislature to make permanent the schedule of 39 substances that the DEA already placed in federal schedule. These items are presently listed as temporarily scheduled, but that temporary status cannot be renewed, so we do need to take action on this. This is essentially a public safety and law enforcement issue. If someone is arrested for a sale or possession of one of these 39 substances, they can't be charged in state courts if their substance is not listed on the state schedule. So it's a very straightforward bill. It's a lot of pages and lists of products, but I'm willing to take questions except how to spell or pronounce some of these compounds. And we also have the privilege of the Board of Pharmacy members in the room for any of the real tough questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Bierman. So just to be clear and make sure that we all understand what this is doing. So first of all, let me just say to members that whenever we get a bill that has to do with rescheduling the schedules of drugs, we always get a lot of pages in a bill. And so it looks like a lot, although the places to focus are kind of few. So it looks like more than it is always. That's just kind of the nature of the beast, right, because of the statutory section has all these different things in it. But so, Representative Bierman, if I'm understanding you, so we're not actually making legal or we're not changing the real status of any of these compounds. We're simply putting them into state statute, what's already the schedule that's already in federal statute. Am I understanding that right?
You are understanding it exactly correctly, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. And any questions for members? And I should ask, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay. And Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your willingness to make this an informational hearing today, just so we had time to look at it, and appreciate your willingness and openness to that. And just wondering for the bill author, when the Board of Pharmacy brought this to you, was there any kind of timeline that they were seeking on getting this done, or do they have any deadlines that are coming up for this?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher, I do believe that it is within the next 6 months. They can give me a wave. Yeah, that is correct. Within the next 6 months, we need to take action on this, or they will fall off that temporary placing.
Representative Schumacher?
Oh, okay, that's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Representative Bierman, I don't know if you have had how much opportunity you've had to sit down with someone from the Board of Pharmacy to kind of walk through what each of these compounds does. So just to make sure I'm understanding it too, these are already in a temporary scheduling in Minnesota, right?
So This bill refers to 39 items that are in this sheaf of papers. It's only the underlined items, and they are in a temporary status right now. And coming to the legislature is the normal procedure. They could go through rulemaking as well, but that's a more timely process and complicated. So they've opted to go through the legislature on this.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, and it, you know, I appreciate that process. And of course, when going through the legislature assumes that the legislature knows what it's doing when it passes the bill. And I just want to make sure that we in fact do. So I wonder, maybe we should have someone from the Board of Pharmacy, if someone's here, to
yes.
just kind of.
Sure, we can have them come down and we can address that.
So
question.
That we put on the record from them some of them.
Madam Chair, I will say that just the fact that the DEA at the federal level has looked at this ahead of us gives me comfort.
Okay. No, thank you very much. And thank you for your willingness to carry this bill, Representative Bierman, because, yeah, welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name and
go
ahead.
I'm Jill Phillips. I'm the Executive Director with the Board of Pharmacy. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank
okay.
you, Representative. Just, again, to clarify, there's 39 substances that need to follow the suit with the federal schedule. 31 of those are in Schedule 1. There and if you look through them again, please don't ask me to pronounce them either, but many are fentanyl analogs, and if I say fentanyl analog, I'm sure that rings a bell to you. Synthetic cannabinoids, there's a couple stimulants, but the main thing to know with the Schedule 1 is there's no medical approved FDA medical use for them, and they have a high potential for abuse. So again, the DEA has made those determinations, so 31 of those 39 substances are in Schedule 1. The others are kind of sprinkled throughout Schedule 2 through 5. Those do have a medical purpose. And again, just scheduled, they're placed in a schedule based on their abuse potential. But again, it's not the Board of Pharmacy making those determinations. We're just trying to keep up with the DEA, and as mentioned, the rulemaking process is one way to tackle that little bit lengthier process. So we were hoping just to make the legislative changes.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Phillips, my understanding from years past is that, like, so when we look at these fentanyl analogs, for example, and tell me if I'm correct in my recall of this, that, you know, the people who do these illegal drugs are very creative in creating new compounds, right? And then if they create a new compound that isn't in the list and nobody has it as a scheduled drug and it's a new compound, then it may be just as harmful and deadly, perhaps, as other drugs, but then we can't do anything about them in terms of having them covered by our criminal laws. Is
that's,
that kind of accurate?
Absolutely correct. Yes.
So all these fentanyl analogs that you've been discussing are kind of in that category?
Correct. We're trying to keep up with what's already occurring.
Okay. Correct. And then the other ones that you said are Schedule 2, could you just talk a little bit about how those are kind of coming to us? As is that somewhat the same process that people are coming up with these new things?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. It is the same process. I believe there's two substances that are being added to Schedule 2, and again, Schedule 2 are typically a little bit more of a potential for abuse and addiction. With Schedule 5 being the least. Again, these 2 through 5, however, they do have FDA approval with an approved indication for medical use.
And so by putting those in law, we're just sort of affirming the way they're handled federally?
Correct.
Okay. Any questions from members on any of this? Please do ask. Yeah, Representative Henningsen-Gager.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As someone who used to every day refer to this particular point in statute to do my job, having them listed specifically the analogs, is very important when you think about the public safety and the criminal aspect. you know, until these are on here, the lab analysts are not able, they can identify it, but the charges can't be brought. So I just want to highlight the importance of having them scheduled.
Yes. Okay, thank you for that. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to ask about all these fentanyls, and it looks like I was concerned whether there was a catch-all for fentanyl with the advent of creative pharmacists or those who create these drugs, and whether that's necessary. But it looks as though there's kind of a catch-all provision. Is there in here? Can you comment about that?
Dr. Phillips?
Do you understand the question?
Right. Yeah. I'm apologize. Thank you for the question. I'm confused on the catch-all. I don't. It really is creative drug abusers finding new ways, creating new compounds all the time. I mean, we. See that just with the cannabinol products, where we have 151.72 now, where we are trying to regulate the new hemp-derived THC products. The cannabis plant alone has, once you start the conversion process, has well over 150 compounds yet to be discovered. Through a synthetic chemical process. Same thing with fentanyl, where these are drugs that are identified as analogs that have been essentially created, and they will continue to be created. So again, we rely on the DEA to identify and assign them to a specific schedule that isn't the responsibility of the board. Does that help answer the question?
So, Dr. Phillips, if I'm understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the answer is you can't just have a catch-all category. You've got to list each one. And maybe I could turn to Mr. Chun for that, too. It wasn't his bill. Okay. But I think that was the answer. But
yes.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you have something to add to that point?
So, again, having them specifically listed makes it extremely clear what you're identifying is and where it's located in statute. You can attempt to do catch-alls. If you look above on page 5, they talk about replacement of an aniline ring with an aromatic monocycle, whether blah, 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 blah. So if you think about a chemical structure, you think of all the little pieces where those joints are. All of those pieces could be modified with someone doing chemistry experiments.
Right.
We cannot possibly know all the ways those modifications can be done. So there is some language that attempts to kind of do that. Again, at the top, it talks about substitution in the phenethyl group. But again, until they're really specifically scheduled, it makes it much clearer. So I don't know if that helped or confused.
Thank you. Very clear. Thank you for that. Yes.
Yeah. And when we're talking about the criminal law, sometimes having that clarity is very important to a prosecution. So, yeah.
Since you brought that up. So in my experience, being able to specifically say 4-methylacetofentanyl on a report clearly tells the prosecutor what has been identified. To have to prove whether it's an isomer, whether it's an ester, an ether, trying to prove the substitution takes a whole other level of expertise, which not all counties really have access to. So again, very good, very supportive of specifically putting them into statute.
Right, thank you. And Representative Carroll, I'm sorry, we got away from your question, but you still can have the floor.
No, it's a fascinating discussion.
Thank you for starting it.
I'm trying to see if I understand it. But my point was that whether we can include language that would serve as a catch-all for all these creative derivatives, and that was my point.
Yeah, right. I think we're kind of. I guess what I'm understanding from the discussion is that we try, but this is important, doing it this way as well. So you kind of got both and here going on a little bit.
Thank you, Chair.
Right. Okay. Any other questions from members? And I don't see any. So Representative Bierman, thank you, Dr. Phillips. Representative Bierman, any closing comments? And
thank you for the good discussion. And I think as we move forward into next session, I think the Board of Pharmacy and we at this table know who the person is who should carry this bill next time.
Oh, sometimes,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Sometimes it can be a little dangerous to ask a question. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. So we will, I'm sure we'll all see House File 1665 coming to probably to an omnibus bill at some point. Okay, with that, we are at the end of our agenda, and so we will see you all on Thursday. And with that, we stand adjourned.